Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Local Government Division on Wednesday, February 2nd, 2022. And I'll call this remote hearing of the Local Government Division to order. And it's being held in accordance with Rule 10.01, which was passed and allows for remote hearings. All remote hearings are recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. The clerk will now take the roll, please.
All right. Good morning. Representative Mason.
Present.
Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Kwan. I know he's already checked in here, too, so we'll reflect that he's there. Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Mecklen.
Present.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Joachim.
Present.
Everyone is present.
Thank you so much. Today we're going to be getting an overview of the Metropolitan Council, and with us we've got Judd Chetnan and Marie Henderson. The floor is yours if you'd like to proceed.
Great. Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's nice to get back into the swing of things here with the legislature. And so we look forward to being able to give you an update on the council's capital and operating budget. And then we're also going to walk through a little bit about our 2022 property tax levy and explain that a bit, talk about some of the directions that each of our divisions are planning for in calendar year 2022. And we're also going to wrap it up with talking about our legislative initiatives, which many of them will be familiar to you in this committee. But with that, I do have a number of staff from the Metropolitan Council with me beyond Marie. Marie is our deputy regional administrator. But I have folks from Metro Transit, our Community Development Committee, and folks from our Environmental Services Committee waiting in the wings. But in the meantime, we'll just kick this off, and I'm going to turn it over to Marie, and we'll go from there. So thanks again for giving us the opportunity to see you this morning.
Good morning, everyone. I am Marie Henderson. Small correction, I am the deputy CFO here at the Metropolitan Council. However, our deputy regional administrator, George Gonzalez, is also online here this morning. Hopefully everyone can see my screen, and we'll go through the slides as Judd has just given you the overview. So we will start with the Council's 2022 Unified Budget and Levy. The Council has statutory responsibilities for planning, operations, and grants. The Council adopts policy plans for transportation, water resources, regional parks, and housing. We operate 9 wastewater treatment plants, collecting approximately 250 million gallons of wastewater daily through the system. That includes over 600 miles of interceptor pipe, 60 pump stations, and 200 metered facilities, and is nationally recognized as a successful and efficient operator. We operate Metro Transit, light rail, commuter rail, metro mobility, and contracted transit services, which provided nearly 38.4 million rides in 2020. It was significantly down from 2019 levels of 82.5 million due to the pandemic. But the 2022 ridership is projected to be at 45.7 million rides to serve customers going to work, school, and entertainment. The Metropolitan Housing and Redevelopment Authority provides services over 7,200 low and moderate income households monthly through rental assistance and provides other housing services to additional clients. This program earns the highest ranking from U.S. Housing and Urban Development and significantly and effective services. the council provides grant funding to communities and to regional parks implementing agencies through our livable communities and park programs. The council's budget development is structured throughout the year. The unified budget has two parts, the operating budget and the capital program. We'll also note that our fiscal year is calendar year, January through December. It is consistent with our partners in the city and county government. Also consistent on how local and county governments operate their budgets, we have many steps to the budget process throughout the year. Presentations to committees and to the council. And from October to early December, we allow for public comment. We give a formal public notice and notice on our website. In addition, it is promoted through council member newsletters and social media. Our unified budget includes levy amounts and is detailed operating budget for 2022, as well as a six-year capital budget plan. On December 8th of 2021, the council approved this unified budget for 2022. So first, taking a look at our 2022 operating budget. The operating budget is $1.2 billion. This is an increase of $71 million from 2021. We have three operating divisions, each with distinctive services and dedicated funding sources. The largest is transportation, which includes our bus, rail, and metro mobility programs, and is 60% of our budget. Our environmental service division provides wastewater treatment programs, which is 27% of our budget. Community development division includes our livable communities, parks, and housing programs. Regional administration provides the common support for services of our operating divisions, such as procurement, human resources, finance, payroll, legal, real estate, and communications. Regional administration is mostly allocated out to the operating divisions. Our OPEB is other post-retirement benefits. And let me just see if I can turn off video. It sounds like maybe having an issue with me. Okay. So the OPEB, our post-retirement benefits, reflects our fully funded status of our closed retiree health care liability and earnings on our OPEB fund balance and are used to pay retiree medical premiums. Funds are invested with the Minnesota State Board of Investment for this purpose. The right side of this pie chart breaks out our budget using operations, pass-through, debt service, and OPEB. This distribution remains familiar and similar year over year for the council. 15% of our funds are used to pay debt service on bonds issued by the council in support of our capital program, of which about 69% of the debt service pays for wastewater treatment infrastructure and is supported by council wastewater fees. Debt service for parks and transit are supported by the council's tax levy. Pass-through funding primarily reflects our housing, livable communities, and parks programs. And nearly 60% of our operation budget pays for salaries and benefits for the council staff. This pie chart shows the funding sources of our operating budget. An important note is that our sources of funding and percents look very similar from year to year. Charges for services include wastewater charges and transit fees. This represents almost one third of our funding. State revenues for MVEST and state appropriation represents 40%. The federal government contributes 16%, $196 million of our operating budget. This is the same percentage as last year. The $196 million in federal funds includes $84 million of pass-through funding for our housing authority. The transportation is budgeted to receive $33 million to support operations in preventative maintenance for our transit fleet and $76 million in federal pandemic relief funds, along with $2.7 million going to pass through for our suburban transit providers. Property taxes support about 8% of our operating budget, primarily funding our debt service and grant programs, and about only 2% supporting operations. Other is primary investment income of our OPEB plan assets. We have planned use of reserves for in our operations, which is primarily transportation. Our 22 budget includes proposed full-time employee of 4,597. This is 40 more than the 2021 budget. Most of this budget increase is in our IS department to update technology systems. Wastewater charges include our municipal, industrial, and sewer availability charges. The budget includes an increase to the municipal wastewater charge of 4%. This is in response to a 2% rate increase in 2021, where we anticipated economic hardships for the communities. However, in 2021, budgeted expenses increased 4%. So the 2022 municipal wastewater charge increase is being done to help recover some of the 2021 shortfall. This represents a $5.40 increase per residential connection, and the average metro household will pay around $30 a month for their sewer services in 2022. Of that amount, 55% goes to the council on average, and the remainder to the local municipalities. Our retail rates for sewer services to households in our region are 35% lower than the national average of our peer agencies across the nation. The sewer availability charges, or SAC, has had no changes since its development and is still robust in the residential market across all housing types. 2020 saw recovery in the commercial development market. Environmental Services continues near perfect compliance with both federal and state clean water standards and data requirements, with six plants receiving the National Association of Clean Water Agency's Platinum Peak Performance Award for 9 years, including one for more than 30 years. There are only two plants in the nation with longer compliance records. An interesting note about COVID-19 and its testing. Environmental Services has developed capabilities to monitor the levels of the SARS-CoV-2 viral RNA, a variant prevalent in the metro plant influent water, wastewater. The result closely tracks the clinical data for the metro plant service area. Environmental Services communicates its results and coordinates details of its testing methods with the Minnesota Department of Health and the University of Minnesota's Geometric Center. Wastewater data is another valuable indicator for COVID-19 conditions within our region. Now turning to our 2022 property tax levy. This chart breaks out, I propose, the 2022 property tax levy. The total levy is 2% increase from 2021 at $90.5 million. A few things to note on this slide. The top section is non-debt service levies. The general purpose levy funds less than 2% of our operations. I will review more details on the next slide about the livable communities non-debt service levies. Our debt service levies are for transit and for parks. The primary use of regional transit bonding is for fleet replacement. We maximize our non-debt services, and this will apply pressure on the future year's payments as we will have funding for future years, but this will not be a sustainable approach to this levy. The Livable Communities Levy, the tax-based revitalization for fiscal disparities is $5 million received from the Fiscal Disparity Program. This Fiscal Disparity Program is a tax-based sharing program within the metropolitan area and is funded by commercial and industrial property, not the homeowners. The Livable Communities Demonstration Account for the 2022 levy is at $13 million. By maximizing this levy, the strategy is to create a transit-oriented development component within the Livable Communities Demonstration Account grant program. The current goal is to reach an annual levy of $13.2 million. This is to annually fund a $7.7 million demonstration account program, $5 million for a transit-oriented development program, and $500,000 required in statute for local housing incentive account. At the 2% increase of our levy, this goal will be reached by our 2023 levy. The Livable Community Account provides funding for communities to invest in local economic revitalization, affordable housing initiatives, and development or redevelopment that connects different land uses and transportation. The program is voluntary, incentive-based approach to help communities grow and redevelop, and to address the regional's affordable and life cycle housing needs. From 1996 through 2020, the council has awarded nearly 1,200 grants, totaling around $436 million in livable community funds. These grants are expected to leverage billions of dollars in private and other public investments. The Local Housing Initiative account receives statutory transfers from the LCDA and the general purpose levies to fund grants to municipalities to help meet their affordable and life cycle housing goals. The council has and will continue to be good stewards of its levy. The Metropolitan Council or the Metropolitan Area Tax are split among several governmental entities. Putting our levy in context with those other metro area taxing jurisdictions. As the graph shows, counties, cities, and school districts account by far the largest portion of the metro area tax dollar. The council typically receives about 1.4% of the revenue of property taxes paid by metro area residents. To further explain, the 2% levy increase on a homeowner with a property value of $250,000 will have the following impact. We have a typical home of $250,000 with the caveat of all things being equal year over year. If the homeowner resides within the transit tax communities, they'll pay around $48, and outside the transit tax communities will pay around $17. As we know, not all things are equal year over year, and individual taxpayers will have different experiences depending upon factors like increasing home values. To also demonstrate the taxing area, our levies are shared across the 7-county metro area, except the transit debt service levy, which is shared by a smaller area serviced by our transit service. This map highlights our metro area and that transit taxing area. The 7-county metro area minus, and going counterclockwise, Hanover, Rockford, New Prague, and Northfield. So the blue area is the transit taxing district established by Minnesota statute. Adding in the red and the blue is the transit capital levy community. Turning over to our council bonds. The council bonds have the highest rating possible from Moody's and from Standard & Poor's, allowing us to borrow at the lowest market interest rates. The AAA was maintained on our 2021 issuance in March for our GO bonds for parks, environmental services refunding bonds, and our GANs. Wastewater fees pay for wastewater bonds. Transit and park bonds are covered by the levy. The grant anticipation notes are paid from federal share of projects. Now turning to our capital program. of 9 billion. This chart represents the progress being made on these projects in the capital program. Authorized and spent is 3.3 billion, or 37%, represents the share of the projects included in the capital program that have already been spent. Authorized and unspent, 2 billion, or 22.3%, represents the remaining share of projects for which funds have already been identified and allocated. Of the authorized and unspent, 97 million is currently anticipated to be spent in the calendar year of 2022. Our plan, or CIP, which is our capital improvement plan, is a six-year plan for projects where funding sources have been identified but not yet secured, and the council has not given final approval. This pie chart shows anticipated funding for the capital program. Financing for the capital program comes from federal, state, local grants, regional borrowing, and other sources. Not all funding has been secured. Federal dollars make up the largest share of our funding source at 35%, followed by local resources at 26%. The regional reflects council bonding authority. Each division has its own funding sources, which may not be intermingled. For example, the Community Development Capital Program includes significant state funding and some regional borrowing. The Transportation Division Capital Program has a mix of funding sources, including significant grants from federal, state, local authorities, counties, and regional borrowing. An Environmental Services Division Capital Program is financed almost entirely through regional borrowing. This slide represents further breakdown of our authorized capital program and the capital improvement plan, authorized and unspent, and planned for each division. The graph on the left represents the $2 billion remaining to be spent in the ACP, projects for which funds have been specifically identified and set aside for those projects. The graph on the right represents the $3.7 billion of projects in the CIP for which specific funds still need to be identified before those projects can consume. So just highlighting some of the each of the division's capital programs and where their focus is. Environmental Services has a focus on preservation assets, improving quality, and to meet capacity requirements. For example, there's a new lift station. It's the L32A. It's an existing lift station located on the west side of the river and is 50 years old and has reached its useful life. The existing lift station also lacks adequate storage to allow for a response time during power outages, which led to sewer backups and odor in the area. There's a Metro Solids renewal and improvement. This existing system does not have capacity to treat the wastewater solids when we're completing renewal work. 500,000 new residents are expected in the Metro Plant service area by 2050. And the new Hastings Wastewater Treatment Plant, decommissioning of the existing Hastings plant in downtown Hastings to meet capacity for future area growth. For transportation, our total fleet of $944 million, $103 million of that is authorized. We plan to purchase over 1,900 buses over the course of our capital program. Rail vehicles are overhauled in line with asset management plans. Bus purchases have been reviewed and adjusted for COVID impacts on service. These vehicles are needed to provide transportation service. This includes buses, including with zero emission fleet, light rail vehicles, and equipment specifically for the vehicles. It also includes midlife overhauls used to extend the useful life of the vehicles. Funding from the regional transit bonds are from federal dollars for the fleet replacement. Transitways, These projects include light rail, commuter rail, and bus rapid transit projects. Funding includes federal, regional bonding, state, counties, and other local funding. Transitway projects increase transit choices for Twin Cities residents. They encourage transit-oriented development that creates residential and business opportunities. For example, the 17-mile Metro Orange Line rapid bus transit opened on December 4th of 2021. This line connects Minneapolis, Richfield, Bloomington, and Burnsville along I-35W. The line, which will provide frequent all-day service in both directions 7 days a week. There's also the Gold Line, which connects people across the region to job centers, housing options, transit stations, and key destinations on I-94 corridor. The planned 10-mile dedicated rapid bus line will connect St. Paul, Maplewood, Landfall, Oakdale, and Woodbury. For customer and support facilities are necessary to maintain and house the fleet and provide other auxiliary facilities to support operations. This includes garages, office space, fueling stations, maintenance, and repairs to the facilities to extend their useful life. Customer facilities are used to encourage transit by providing hubs for buses so riders can transfer from one route to another, providing parking spaces for transit users, sheltering riders from the elements, and providing other amenities to encourage and facilitate transit use. Energy enhancements include LED lighting at facilities, park and rides, and stations. Most LED enhancements have a 4-year return on investment or less. And other includes technology improvements. That includes communication and computer equipment necessary to operate the transit system. This includes radios, dispatch systems, automatic vehicle locators, and mobile data terminals. Other capital equipment include things as tow trucks, supervisor vehicles, police vehicles, bus lifts, bus washes, and fare boxes. The Twin Cities metropolitan area is home to a system of regional parks and trails that are nationally renowned for beauty, size, and variety of features. With 56 regional parks and park reserves totaling more than 45,000 acres, nearly 400 miles of interconnected trails, and 8 special recreational features, the system provides a wealth of opportunity for recreation, exercise, and social distancing fun. It also provides significant green space and wildlife habitat. The regional park system draws over 63 million visitors every year. Our system adds untold value to the livable and attractiveness of our communities. Switching topics, I would like to talk about our Equity Advisory Committee. It advises the Metropolitan Council in its work to advance equity in the metropolitan region. For the purpose of this committee, equity is defined by our Thrive MSP 2040. Equity connects all residents to opportunity and creates viable housing, transportation, and recreation options for people of all races, ethnicities, incomes, and availabilities and abilities so that all communities share the opportunities and challenges of growth and change. For our region to reach this full economic potential, all of our residents must be able to access opportunity. Our region is strong when all people live in communities that provide them access to opportunities for success, prosperity, and the quality of life. The Equity Advisory Committee membership is 4 Metropolitan Council members, each one from the Council's Community Development, Environment, Transportation, and Management Committees. There are 8 geographic members, one from each of the following districts. Each district is made up of 2 of the council districts. So, for example, Council District 1 and 2 is District A for this committee. Council District 3 and 4 is is District B, and so on for the 8 geographic members. There are 9 at-large members, each of whom must be a resident of the 7-county metro area as defined by Minnesota State statute. Of the geographic and at-large members, the following groups should have at least one representative: African Americans, Asian Americans, Native Americans, Latinos, immigrants and new Americans, low wealth residents, and people with disabilities. And with that, I will turn my talking points over to Judd.
Thanks, Marie, and thanks for clarifying that you are a deputy chief financial officer, and so I really appreciate that. Madam Chair, just a couple footnotes I'd like to add is before we get into our legislative work is that as long as we're giving an update about the council, I'd like to share with you that we have 2 vacancies currently on the Metropolitan Council. We've got Council Member Linnea Atlas Ingebrigtsen, who recently left, and we are in the process of getting that that District 6 seat filled. I believe I expect Governor Walz will be making that appointment here in the next couple weeks. And then just recently, Chris Ferguson, who represents the Eden Prairie area, who's our management committee chairman, left yesterday, I guess, on Monday was his last day at the council. And that will now be an open seat. And so we will go through the process of seating a new council member there as well. And then just to carry this out a little bit further, we will, after the election in November, we will have a new council that will be seated early next spring. And then the legislature will bring forward a redistricting plan for the Metropolitan Council next year. And then we'll go through the process of seating a council again, probably late next summer. What oftentimes happens during the redistricting plan, however, is that the seats where there are members who are redistricted together are basically the seats that then will be reseated, and then the open districts will be reseated, and it won't be the full slate of council members at that point in time. So just kind of a heads up on the actual makeup of the council and how that will all play out. But I don't know if you have any other questions related to Marie's piece. Otherwise, I will give you kind of a high-level overview of where we're at with our legislative initiative, and happy to proceed however you would like.
Why don't you finish then, and then we'll take questions.
Great. Well, thanks again, Madam Chair and members. Just to walk through the council's legislative initiatives, the first bill that we are looking to continue to move forward with is a Representative Elkins bill, House File 1306, which is administrative citation initiative. I think many members of this committee are familiar with. I think the legislature is familiar with this as well. This has been something that the council has brought forward to the legislature since 2019. It does 2 things in particular. Number one, it allows us to decriminalize the penalty for a fare evasion. It takes it from a misdemeanor down to an administrative citation. And then this bill also allows us to have someone other than a sworn police officer to be able to write a ticket. And what we believe that allows us to have community service officers, that those types of positions, to be able to have a presence, be able to check tickets on our system. And we think that we get all the broader benefits of having that presence on our system, on our platforms, at our stations, and on the vehicles. And hopefully that becomes a something that will allow us to make people feel safe and want to ride our system. And we feel that that's just a great way to approach this. And there is police work that we'd like to have our police focus on, and believe that the fare evasion, fare checking can be done probably better by these community service officers, who can also serve, you know, as provide other information, help people get to where they want to go, and just be able to hopefully have a strong and friendly presence on our transit system. The second initiative of ours is our inflow and infiltration mitigation program. First of all, the administrative citation bill, I believe, was sent back to the Representative Mariani's committee, the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Committee. So I hope that that will be picked up there again and we can continue to move that forward. The inflow and infiltration mitigation program, again, this bill was carried by Representative Freiberg. This bill was actually heard in your committee last year, and I believe it was moved forward to state government finance. It went through, I believe, unanimously through the House and the Senate. Senator Osmick is carrying this bill in the Senate, and there is broad support for us to establish to allow the Metropolitan Council to establish a INI mitigation program. Our bill is very simple. All we are doing is to amend the current definition of a city to include entities that operate or own sewer systems, which in the case of the metro area is the Metropolitan Council, which allows us to establish a program to a grant program for INI mitigation. And we, to take this just a little bit further, since folks are probably familiar with it, we're looking to take a piece of our municipal wastewater charge in order to develop this program. We believe that is an appropriate place to do this because that program can oftentimes be used for capital expansion. We think if we use it to go into INI mitigation that we're actually getting a better bang for the buck. We're not having to build better or bigger pipes. And at the same time, we're getting the clean water out of our system, and we're also protecting the environment. And I think everyone has rallied around this and believes it is a good idea. Unfortunately, at the end of last session, it stalled, even though I don't believe there was a single vote against this initiative in either body. So we're hoping to be able to move forward with that. We can go to the next slide here. So the next few slides are allowing the council here. I just have an issue with my screen real quick. To do a few things. The first relates to our advisory committee initiative. I'm sorry, you guys. I am having an issue here with my screen here. Let me just try this real quick. Okay. The first initiative that we will have is to authorize the council to provide compensation for advisory committee members. The amount hasn't been determined, but it would allow us to pay up to $55 per day for committee activities. We have over 10 advisory committees at the Metropolitan Council, and we believe that moving forward with this would allow us a broader range of participation on these advisory committees, so that folks potentially we can cast a broader net and have people included who may otherwise have had reasons to not participate based on conflicts with jobs or just not being able to participate for whatever reason. And so we already provide compensation for travel, and we believe that this would be paid out of that same account. We also have an initiative to improve opportunities for disadvantaged businesses. And what we're looking to do is to expand some programs and modify preferences for targeted group businesses. I can provide more detail on that if you'd like. I would fully expect that this would likely come through your committee, Madam Chair. And I'll run through these, and if we want to dig into these a little bit deeper, we certainly can. We are looking at authorizing a pay-as-you-go financing for our regional parks and capital projects. And what that does is adds flexibility to finance some projects on a pay-go basis rather than issuing bonds. We believe that this makes financial sense. If we have the funds, it doesn't make any sense for us to have to go through this financial process of issuing bonds and having to pay for that when we could just straight up pay for that if we have the funds available. We think it is a much more efficient use of funds and, again, avoiding the expense of issuing these bonds. It is a smart financial approach. It just is something that we would like to get achieved here this next session. The next slide, please. These next ones are some what we would consider more technical and housekeeping proposals. We have legislation that will allow us to clarify some agricultural preserves administrative timeline. This comes out of our community development committee, and Lisa Barajas is here with us to answer any questions related to that. There is a little bit of ambiguity in that statute, and we're looking to tighten that up so as to not have that ambiguity there anymore. I'm going to wait with that, and if there's questions, I'll have Lisa dig into those. And just so members know that these council initiatives will then be sent to leadership in the House and Senate. And so these bills, as agency bills, are then provided to the members of the caucuses. And so it is the determination of if these bills are moving forward will come from your leadership. I won't be walking around with the green jackets looking for authors just yet, unless I'm providing them, and then I will come knock on your door. The next initiative we have is to simplify the Livable Communities Local Housing Initiatives account requirements. Again, I'm going to defer to Lisa on that. We are looking to modify reporting for Metropolitan Significance Rules. I think folks on this committee are probably pretty familiar with the Metro SIG statutes. Currently, we have to do a review every 2 years. We're looking at kicking that out to about every 10 years. We're not looking to do anything beyond that. However, Metro Significance oftentimes has been excluded, exempted from any major metro area issues in the past that have come before the legislature. I think the last time that the council actually did a significant Metro SIG review, I believe, was back in 2001, and it may have been the Black Dog Amphitheater in Burnsville, if I recall, but that now was over 20 years ago. And so, this bill, the current statute has us do this review every 2 years. Well, it's been 21 years now since we did the last significant review. So we're asking for a little bit of wiggle room to extend that to come back every 10 years. So we think that is very reasonable. The next one is to amend the timeline for regional park operations and maintenance reimbursements to use audited expenses. There is a little bit of tension. I think I shouldn't say tension. There's a bit of a rub about when funds are being used and the dollars are being provided to the parks implementing agencies. This is a very, very simple clarification that we can get into as well if you would like. And then the last one is to clarify the classification of certain transit data as private. Currently, our go-to cards, that information is private. That's already protected under the data practices statute. However, when folks fill out their forms in order to get into that program, those forms aren't necessarily covered. And so we're just trying to make sure that we are putting that entire layer of information into being classified as private. And that seems relatively reasonable, but I'll be the first one to recognize that anytime you're trying to classify certain data as private, that it opens up all kinds of issues. And so with that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to provide more detail on any of these, but I also wanted to make sure that you were aware of our legislative initiatives for calendar year, for the 2022 session, and look forward to responding to any questions you may have. So thank you for that.
Thank you very, very much. I do have one question, and it has to do with the this is good. I just lost my picture here. It has to do with the Equity Committee. And I know that she mentioned, trying to provide services. And the question, just a little clarification, is it just making sure that the various populations that need extra services are getting it? Or does that also impact the hiring and participation on the various committees?
Well, Madam Chair, that is a good question. I am going to look here and see if I can phone a friend on that. Can we? Well, let's move to the next question, and I'm going to track some. I don't see the person on here to be able to answer that specific question. So while we're answering the next one, I'm going to track the person down who can answer that question for you. Is that okay?
That will be fine. Right now, I'm not seeing any hands. Am I missing something?
Okay. Madam Chair, then, if you would like, I apologize. I don't have the right person on the meeting here to answer that. Would you be okay if I took your question and emailed a response to the entire committee with that?
That will work. Okay. Thank you very much. The Orange Line was mentioned, and obviously that's a really new program. Do we have some type of figures about how that is operating at this point in time?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And you are right. This is brand new service that started, back in early December. And I think, let me see if our general manager, Wes Koistra, is available to be able to give us a quick update on where we're at with the Orange Line. Looks like Wes is here.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Koistra.
As you mentioned, the Orange Line was just opened in December, so we really don't have a reliable number yet as far as its performance. We've gotten really good feedback from our customer base on that line and how that's improved their commute into work. But I'd like to kind of hold off on giving a final word of performance after really only a couple of months and having a major Omicron spike in the middle of those 2 months as well. So if you could, I will recall the question, and as we get more data in for the coming months, I'll send you an update on that.
Okay, thank you very much. Let me ask you one question. How was it? I know that it's gotten quite a bit of publicity. Did you do anything beyond just the normal publicity about that route to make sure that people that have the, various businesses, et cetera, to take advantage of that net line?
Yeah, absolutely. Madam Chair, members of the committee, absolutely. We had a very robust marketing campaign for the Orange Line. We had an event out at both the Lake Street Station and the Burnsville station, and an event there, and we've used social media and our website as well as other marketing events to promote and make sure people had schedules and did quite a bit of promotion for it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Am I missing any questions? I see Representative
Meekland. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I have a couple of questions. Actually, I have a lot of them, but earlier on, you part of the presentation mentioned what the total ridership was for all forms of Met Transit, and it was, I believe, in the 80 million range of rides, and then it's down to, last year was down to 40 due to the pandemic. Being that I have the North Star light rail that comes up here, and that ridership is down, I believe it's still down like 90%. It's become one of the most expensive, non-used. You get a car to yourself, if not two. But, and then we've seen all the news now of this new Southwest Line rail that's gone way beyond budget. I think it's pushing an additional 700 some million, an additional 3 years. But, we kind of hear often it's due to the pandemic, but people up here, really the biggest thing I'm hearing is people no longer feel safe going into the metro. And if they're going to go into the metro, they're not going to do it on a train and limit their ability to flee if they need to. How do you propose to combat all of that? Plus, how do we rein in the cost of all these trains that nobody seems to want to ride? If somebody could address that.
Madam Chair, I will start. I will start with that. And Representative, related to your question related to the North Star line, the pandemic has had a devastating impact on the ridership of our commuter express service, not just for North Star, but for our commuter express bus service and for the suburban transit provider commuter express bus service. And last year, as part of the transportation budget agreement, there was an initiative that was included to have the Center for Transportation Services at the University of Minnesota conduct a study to look at the long-term impacts of the pandemic on commuter express service. And so we will be working with them, providing that information, but it is, there's no doubt that that the North Star line singled out in particular has taken it really on the nose and probably as hard as anything that we have in our entire system as far as that as far as that service. I will say that that we are leaning in to transit safety. As I mentioned earlier, we have this initiative that we have been trying to pass with the legislature for the past many years that we are beginning to see, or that we do have bipartisan support in the House with Representative Koznick, Representative Torkelson, who are both very, very strong voices for us on this issue, along with our chief author, Representative Elkins, to try to give us additional tools to be able to have more people on our transit system, on our trains, on our platforms, checking fares, having that presence, making sure that people are feeling comfortable. And so we are trying our best in order to make sure that we are putting forward those types of efforts in order to make sure that people come back to the transit system when and if we get over this pandemic sometime soon. I mean, we were hoping that, you know, that we'd be gearing up for people to come back sooner than later. But to Wes Koester's point, the Delta variant came and the Omicron variant came, and that has just stretched out the impact that it's having on our transit system as well. And so I appreciate your frustration with this. We're frustrated with it as well, but we want to make sure that when people come back to the transit system that they feel comfortable. And then related to the Southwest line, we are frustrated with that as well. We do believe, you know, that we are not planning for this investment for the next 5 years. We're looking at this investment for the next 25, 50 years. And there are strong reasons to make sure that we are investing in regional transit, particularly these core transportation components for the economic benefits to the region, for the environmental benefits to the region, and for the equitable investments to the region, because we know that the region is going to continue to grow. And we have to make sure that people are going to be able to move throughout the region. And so these aren't short-term investments. These are long-term investments. I will also share with you that we share the frustrations as well, but there are some unforeseen issues that have, you know, arisen in that project related to the Kenilworth Corridor and to the barrier protection wall that we're dealing with. And so we are as frustrated, but we also believe in these projects and are moving forward and making sure that we are going to be able to deliver them. So long answer, I'm sorry, but I just wanted to try to cover all of the different space that you were asking questions about.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Meekland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, and I appreciate the, you know, the attention to increase security on the trains itself or the buses, what have you. But in part to that response, if the people don't feel safe once they get off the train because they feel it's too unsafe in the inner city or the metro, whether it be going to a, you know, major sporting venue or what have you, or going out of the town. I mean, I think the problem is a little bit bigger than just getting more security. I mean, which is definitely needed on the rail system and others, but it's also the issue of what's happening down there with crime and violence. And so I think that part needs to be addressed in this as well. My other question I would like to ask pertains to the push to these electric buses. And if somebody can answer that there's lots of stories about, you know, these buses do not work when it's incredibly cold out. They're far heavier. They're harder on roads from that aspect. Is there going to continue to be a push to move to more electric that obviously is somewhat or heavily crippled in these kind of temperatures we're experiencing as of currently? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, Madam Chair, I can respond to that
Mr.
as well. Related to the electric bus technology, this is really sunrising technology. And so I would guess I would harken back to the early 2000s when we were moving into hybrid type technology for our bus system. And we expect the technology to become better and more resilient that way. I would say that one of the things that is really going to kickstart that is the federal infrastructure bill is making a major investment in no or low emission bus investments, and we are going to see the benefit of that here in the metro area. There are major reasons for why we would like to make sure that we are moving to that type of technology, and environmental being a major one. We also will see, as this technology becomes more of the standard throughout the system, or throughout the field or across the country, that the cost of these buses will be reduced over time. It's the same thing that we experienced with the hybrid technology 20 years ago. And so I appreciate your question, Representative Mecklen. I think your other question was related to safety beyond the transit system. I will say that, you know, what we've experienced is that the transit system and our investments in ABRT and the bus system have proven to be very resilient despite the pandemic. And so I think that people are still using the transit system. I think that they are for the most part feeling relatively safe about where they're going after they get off of the bus or train. But we are in the our numbers show, you know, that people are using the system to get to work, to get to school, and as far as Metro Transit and the Metropolitan Council's perspective is that we're leaning on this, and we want to make sure that people feel safe and welcome and want to use the transit system when they come back. And in fact, we are continuing to invest in the transit system. The governor just proposed another $60 million to invest in ABRT systems to advance the F, G, and H lines in our region, and on top of the investments that the legislature has made recently as well. So we strongly believe that there is a need for a strong transit system, and that people are using it and will continue to use it. And as our region grows, it becomes that much more important. And I'm sorry if I'm going on and on, but I just want to make sure that we are making those points.
Thank you. Representative Mecklen, are you?
No, one just quick follow-up here, Madam Chair. You know, okay. There's been a lot of write-ups up here with regard to the North Star, and I, in fact, last week I had to go pick somebody up because it just wasn't working, and he had to wait 2 more hours, so it was quicker for me to go down and pick him up and bring him back. But when you have one person on 3 cars, what everybody's trying to figure out is, why don't we just snowball this thing and then use the buses for all the way from St. Cloud all the way down, because one bus could certainly carry the few riders that are wanting to ride. It just seems to me that we are throwing a tremendous amount of money away on a lot of this stuff at a time when inflation's skyrocketing for all the taxpayers out there. And, you know, earlier there was mentions about new levies through the Met Council on people based on property value. So last year, property value skyrockets up. And this year, inflation is skyrocketing up, so they have less dollars to actually pay for everyday goods. And it seems to me that there seems to be a lack of concern for every taxpaying Minnesotan with all these pipe dreams that seems like nobody wants to write. So I'm just going to leave it at that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd like to respond real briefly.
Mr. Shetland.
I want to make sure that Representative Mecklen is aware that we have made a significant service reductions in the North Star service. We have gone from, I believe it was 6 trips a day down to 2 on our service, and then we don't have weekend service on that anymore. So it's not like we're running the same service that we were previously. I know we talk about this regularly in the Transportation Committee, so I appreciate Representative Mecklen raising this, because we oftentimes don't get the opportunity to share that information. So we have made those significant adjustments in that North Star service as well. And we are wanting to make sure that we're not making long-term decisions in a middle of a pandemic. And so I think that what we are looking forward to is this information that we're going to receive from the Center for Transportation Services, and then take an objective look at what things look like once we have that information, and once we hopefully are able to put this pandemic to bed once and for all.
Thank you. And I'd like to make a comment as well. For a number of years, I served on the board for the Minnesota Valley Transit Authority. And you cannot just make arrangements for routes quickly, because if people take a job and they're relying on this particular resource, it really makes it very hard for the, you know, they need to know there's reliability. So that's an aspect that's weighs heavily whenever you're doing any type of route situations. Next, Representative Elkins, and then Representative Olson.
I think Representative Olson is first.
Oh, okay. Representative Olson, proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm just missing one little puzzle piece, I think, in this whole thousand piece puzzle. And so I don't know who to address the question to, but I'll just go with it. You know, I've ridden the train one time when I was maybe 15 years old with my dad to a Twins game. And then I ride the train from Fort Snelling to the airport when the Army sends me on places. But my question is here, you know, most of my constituents have probably done a similar aspect. I've never ridden on a Metro bus. I have yet to experience that great pleasure. But we're taxpayers, and we're talking about increasing staff on our Metro Transit. Well, at the same time, we're going to be giving administrative citations to individuals who decide not to pay. You know, an administrative citation has absolutely zero teeth. You can't chew meat with that kind of a thing. An administrative citation, one of these public safety individuals who are writing those out, I mean, you could just rip it up in their face and that would be just about it. So my question is, do we honestly think, or where's the logic behind this, where we're going to be increasing taxpayer dollars, hiring these people who will be writing out a piece of paper that has no teeth whatsoever? Can someone explain, are we just going to be paying for these out of the goodness of our hearts when these people who are receiving these citations are not paying their fare out of the goodness of their heart? You know, the stop from Fort Snelling to the airport, it's one stop, and I still pay my fare to go that one stop because it's out of the goodness of my heart. And I you know, no one's ever asked me if I paid the fare for that one stop. But, you know, I think the people who are paying their fare are doing it out of the goodness of their heart. And will they continue to do that when there is no teeth at all in an administrative citation? So that's my question. Can someone please, you know, shine some light on that for me?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I can answer that question. That's kind of what I wanted to address.
Okay, anyway. Representative Elkins.
Yeah, thank you. So the administrative citations bill passed the House Transportation Committee 15-1, a bipartisan vote, and currently we moved it to the floor. It's now back in the Criminal Justice Committee. I'm going to ask Chair Mariani to move it back to the general register so that we can pass it. But to answer Representative Olson's question directly, one of the reasons that we're doing this is right now is that with the current criminal citations that are the only thing that Metro Transit can issue, the prosecutors just won't prosecute the crimes because the penalties are so disproportionate to the level of the offense. You know, essentially not paying a fare is kind of like, not paying, parking for free, not paying, feeding the meter, and it ought to be punished proportionately. We believe, and all of the evidence supports this, is that if you make the penalty proportionate to the crime, it's much easier to prosecute, that it will be prosecuted like any other administrative offense, and it will be far more effective that way. And the big difference will be is just that there will be a lot more people who will be able to be on the trains issuing the administrative citations, because to issue an administrative citation, you don't have to be a sworn peace officer. So like every agency, like every municipality, Metro Transit has, there's a shortage of peace officers. We want those peace officers to be focusing on major crimes, not petty crimes like fare evasion. So it's a both and. Metro Transit is beefing up its security operations. We want the sworn peace officers to focus on the serious crimes, and we want a larger force of not sworn peace officers available to have a pragmatically effective way of addressing fare evasion.
Thank you. Follow up, Representative Olson.
Oh, I would just say I think that was a really good answer. I appreciate that. If we're focusing on public safety as we should be, then, you know, we're buying a bigger net and we're going to throw it out. Maybe we'll catch a couple more fish. But if public safety is truly the number one priority, which it absolutely should be, then that's a really good answer. So I appreciate that. Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Representative Elkins.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Elkins, you had a question.
That was the main thing I wanted to address anyway, but I just want to go back. So can you remind me again, this is probably at the beginning of the presentation, but how much is the council's levy going up this year?
Representative Elkins, I'm going to defer to Marie here because she just popped up. Great.
Yeah. This year's levy is 2%.
Henderson.
2% this year. It's been 2% for many years, except for last year, we actually held the levy at 0%.
Yeah, so it's just my experience. And
Representative Elkins.
I met council for 8 years myself, is that as long as I can remember, the Met Council has been able to hold its levies to that 2% or so range, which is far less than any of the other local governments in the metro area have been raising their own levies. And if you look at if you live in the metro area and look at your property tax bill, it is, you know, broken out there on your truth and taxation statements. And it's a tiny part of your overall property tax bill. But over the years, the council has been very judicious in its increases to its levy. As you saw from the revenue breakdowns, it's actually a small part of the council's budget. A lot of it is pass-throughs of federal revenues, data from user fees and other sources, but council has always been very, very conservative in its annual levy increases. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for covering the levy issue, Representative Elkins. I think on my bill, it ranks down there as low as mosquito control, but I'd have to check again. And I want to thank you for carrying the bill on the transit fares. It really is a good example when you said that it's like plugging a meter. We don't have our police officers going and ticketing vehicles. We have meter readers usually, and they're probably not called that anymore. But it just makes sense that we have them be able to focus on things that are more important. And, you know, I think we all obey rules because it's beyond the goodness of our heart. It's the right thing we do. I know I don't stop at stop signs just because of the goodness of my heart. I do it because that's what the law is. And I am concerned with a lot of the rest of everyone on the hit that our metro area economies have taken from COVID. When you don't have folks coming downtown, things change. And hopefully with some of the recovery that we're doing and the help we're doing for our small businesses, we will have that economic engine of our state back running on all four cylinders, so to speak. And that we have, once we have that, you got to remember about 40% of the folks coming into Minneapolis to work when we're at full strength are coming in on transit. So we can't afford to let our transit lag. And we also have to remember those of us sometimes that aren't transit dependent forget that we have a lot of folks that are transit dependent, not just to get to work, but to get to doctor's appointments, to go grocery shopping. So we really need to strengthen that transit system. It helps all of us and it helps our entire economy. So just wanted to throw that out there and thanks for the discussion.
Thank you. Representative Hoyt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know who can take this question, but Representative Joaquin, I think they're going to refer him to maybe possibly like parking coaches, just to use a better term, maybe. Anyways, one of the curiosity, and I'm looking at an optimistic picture here, because I know I've been involved with a Vikings game that has been packed. I know that the Gopher Wisconsin game was standing only. I know that the boat show that I went to was packed. I know that the chamber dinner was packed. I know that these sporting events, and most people do take the trains. And I'm empathetic with maybe we have some crime problems, but I think also we're doing a good job at working towards that. I think people are getting more comfortable. Are you seeing that on your transit? Are you seeing during these big events that we're back to those levels where we have a number of full trains and full buses going towards these these folks, and I'm just kind of curious if you're seeing a transit, or are you still seeing most people driving in?
Thank you. Who wants to take that?
Madam Chair, this is my name is Ian Westquistra. We are seeing much more ridership for events, as you suggest. Certainly the major events like the Vikings and other events, we're seeing a pickup in that. We were actually seeing a pickup in our ridership over the summer and fall, and currently we're certainly higher than our low ridership levels in 2020. So we're seeing a slow pickup of ridership. I will say I just saw January's. December's numbers were around an overall system-wide 50% loss of ridership. At one point, we were down system-wide somewhere around 65, 66%. So that is improving. I did see January numbers. There was a little drop in January's numbers, and I think that's likely due to the peaking of the Omicron virus and some of the harsh weather that we had that will reduce ridership in any year. But you're right, we're seeing a pickup in ridership. We're trying to keep services ahead of that curve, and we're really excited to get people back. There was return to work. We work really closely with downtown businesses and understand what their return to work ideas are. And of course, they've been on again and off again as well as the pandemic has evolved. So we stay in communication with that, and we're really hopeful for the time when the pandemic is over and people start returning to work and ride transit. But I wanted to also emphasize what Representative Yoakie mentioned, is that we're such an important service for people, not just for events, not just for going to work with people who may have other options, but also for people who truly rely on transit every day. We are really, our job is to be a connection to opportunity, to provide mobility services for people who need it most. And we have been providing those critical services throughout this time of low ridership. That's why ridership has stayed up higher in the local routes than it has in, for example, express routes, because our primary service is in the local areas.
Madam Chair, I'd like a follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative Hoyt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that. That was a really good explanation. And then also just to hit on public safety a little bit, I'm totally impressed with what I see with the Met, the law enforcement officers that do work for the Metropolitan Council. And you always see them at the Capitol. And I do have to say, I've seen a victim go down close to a track, and the compassion your officers played in that and making sure that they got care in a cold day was unbelievable. What are you looking at for Phil right now? How many officers are you down?
Mr. Questra.
Madam Chair, we are down about 33 officers of a total complement of about 170. Those are vacancies. That doesn't include how many officers we are down with respect to being out due to the Omicron positive cases or contact tracing. But I will say we are seeing much, much less absentees due to the pandemic. But our vacancy rate right now is we're down about 33, and we are actively recruiting. And of course, everybody's actively recruiting officers right now. Everybody's trying to attract officers, or some officers are moving from one jurisdiction to another. So we're all competing for the same people, and it's a tough recruiting environment right now.
Thank you. Is there a follow-up, or are you?
No, my time is done, Chair. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Quam will be the last person we'll take today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, through this discussion about transit, trains are so 1800-ish. For a few years, I and others have been pushing for more of a flexible, modern, use the logistics that we have. Frankly, FedEx, Amazon, et cetera, they don't know days ahead, weeks ahead, when they're going to have X people and what locations. And we should be utilizing the technology so that we have smaller buses that people can go on an app and say, I want to go from here to here, and these are the time frames, and it schedules the route, the pickup and the drop off. It's highly compatible with electric in that you can have the software monitor, and then you rotate replacement vehicles while the one bus is charging. You get into neighborhoods, and you're running at 60, 80% capacity on every bus. That would be efficiency. That would be responsive to people. That would help the people that are have mobility issues, and they live 10 blocks from the train stop. So we keep continuing this 1800s thought of transportation instead of thinking about the future. And now that we've got this sort of a downturn in ridership, would be a great opportunity to look at a 21st century transit components that would be more responsive to the people. And frankly, when autonomous routes come in, and we've got autonomous buses testing in Rochester, so it's not that far off, they would be able to directly tie into the same logistics software. And efficiency means cost savings, but also means better service to the people. So I keep hoping for 21st century transit thought and planning, and maybe some of the one-time funding that we've got this year would be able to push that so the people will have the services they need, but it'll be the services that are needed, not a bunch of large buses that half the time are running fairly empty and on a fixed schedule that, you know, isn't as much of a service as a intelligent logistics driven transit solution that would be, you know, again, let's make it easier for the people to use a transit system, and maybe actually they'll use it. I rode a Metro Transit bus, probably a different name, when I was in the dorms at the U of M, and used it to go to an event. So I've ridden the bus, and you know, I guess mainly I'm asking that maybe we have some new cutting edge improvements instead of turning the crank on the old stuff. And thank you.
Mr. Koistra, and we do need to end by 10 o'clock.
Madam Chair, I'll keep it under 12 minutes here. I really appreciate the comment that we need to look at the future of transit. And I view it a little differently than the representative. I think that we are, for example, piloting an on-demand service beginning in May or May or June. And we're going to be excited to see how that service works. I think that it's not an either or question. It's often a both and proposition, that there is a strong place for rail in our transit service system. It has proven to be a great performer, before this recent pandemic. We are seeing strong performance out of arterial bus rapid transit that provides frequent fast and all-day service in major corridors. We've seen 30% increase in ridership in those corridors. But I just want to say that I agree wholeheartedly that this is an opportunity to look at our future and reexamine how we approach transit and think about some models and some ways to evaluate transit in a ways that are different than what we might have done in the past. Access is such an important issue, as I mentioned before. We really need to look at how at the issues of access and how we connect people to work, better connect people to work and to opportunities. And I think that anytime you go through a crisis like we've gone through today, those are the opportunities in that crisis. So I agree with the premise. We may not agree on the details.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. Representative Kwan.
Thank you. Part of the issue is we're talking billions of dollars for the expansion of the rail system. And for billions of dollars, we could have, well, for less than that, much less than that, we could really fully do a more responsive, modern feeder to our express bus routes and the current train routes, so that if we make it easier to use, we're going to start using the capacity on the express and the trains. And that is just, you know, once you spend $2-3 billion, it's not there for you to do what I think is a more appropriative, responsive transit activity. That's why it should be part of the discussion now, because I understand there are a large amount of dollars that might be going this session into some of the train systems.
In view of the time, I'm going to suggest that I know the Transportation Committee will be working on that. So I'll defer to them on that. And before we end today, Representative Elkins, would you be willing to move approval of the March 24th, 2021 minutes?
I will so move, Madam Chair.
Thank you. If everybody would put on their deal so they can vote, I'd appreciate that. All those in favor of the are there any additions or corrections? Okay, if not, all those in favor of the approving the minutes of March 24th, say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Okay, the minutes of March 24th, 2021 stand approved as read. And again, thank you everybody for your participation today. The meeting is adjourned.